So this is the final Dhamma talk, but I'm going to use most of it to try and get through some of these questions, which still keep on coming in, and I'll try and be very quick with them. These are questions on meditation, but every now and again there'll probably be a question on relationships or suicide and goodness knows what else. Dear Ajahn, when we do walking meditation, is it important to do mental noting, such as left, right, lifting, pushing, etc.? Is it good enough we are aware of the movement without noting? It is much better to be aware of the movement without noting if you can do it. But if your mind is restless, then doing a noting gives you more to focus your attention on, which means that you're less likely to have a wandering mind. Somehow or other, you don't seem to have too much trouble with sloth and torpor when you're walking. I've never seen anyone fall asleep when they're doing walking meditation. But restlessness is a problem with walking meditation, so if you can do the walking meditation without noting, that is best. However, if you are doing walking meditation and you are restless and you need something to focus your attention on the walking, then do noting. And as you're doing the noting, once your mind settles down and is settled enough to be able to watch the movement of the feet without noting, then just go on to the bare awareness of the movement without any noting. That is the best. Some textbooks say to be reborn as a human being is difficult. So well done, all of you. You've made it. I think in the time of the Buddha, it definitely was very difficult because the number of human beings on the earth was very small. Now there's a huge growth in the population. So now these days, it's relatively much easier to be reborn as a human being. So it really depends upon the time. So this is a very good time to be reborn as a human being because there's many, many opportunities to be reborn as a human being with such a huge population. And as it happens, usually if you die as a human being, your whole identification is with a human form. So it's very likely when you die, if you've just done an ordinary amount of good karma, you're not especially bad or especially good, the chances are, yes, you will get reborn as a human being, simply because that's what you crave for. To get reborn, there are two factors which determine where you're reborn. This is straight from the Upapati Sutta. That is your craving and your karma. So if you have enough karmic credit and you want to be reborn in that realm, then you get reborn there. In the same way that, say you want to go to Australia to visit me. The only way you get to Australia is for two reasons. One, you can afford it. And number two, you want to get there. So the same if you want to get reborn, say in a Deva realm or a human realm, you've got to be able to afford it. In other words, have enough good karma. And you want to get there. And a lot of people, because they're human beings, and this is what we think we are, that we're inclined, we'll actually probably will get reborn as human beings. Simply because that's what we want. That's where we think we belong. In the same way, there are many pets, especially in Western countries, dogs especially, who get treated like human beings. And they don't eat dog food anymore. They eat the same food their owners eat. And they go to a hairdresser. And they and they live in air-conditioned kennel. So some of those dogs, they associate with human beings so much that obviously when they get reborn, they'll get reborn as a human being. I can't resist this story. There was a monkey in Thailand who somebody found them in a market and was very badly treated, so took them to a monastery. And it was a forest monastery, and so the monks took this little monkey in. And the monkey was hanging out with the monks all day. And so whenever it was tea time for the monks in the afternoon, the monkey would come along and would also sit with the monks, would have to have his own cup of tea. And he obviously thought he was the same as everybody else, because he would sit there drinking his tea, quiet and peaceful. And you know, he identified with being human so much that when he did die, the abbot was a very powerful meditator. He actually did see his stream of consciousness leave the body. He got hit by a car in front of the monastery. Saw his stream of consciousness leave the body and enter the womb of a pregnant woman in the village. And his mistake was he told the other monks about this. So the other monks were waiting and waiting and waiting for this girl to give birth. And sure enough, the baby she gave birth to
was extraordinarily hairy for a baby. And everybody knew who that baby was. It was a monkey who lived in a monastery the past life. So it really was a little monkey in both senses of the words. And so they actually saw, they could see that that was a human being in a previous life. Sorry, a monkey in a previous life. But through association, you know, with actually good human beings, and made that transition to a rebirth as a human. So if you really want to have another crack at enlightenment next time, you really want to be reborn as a human being, make an aspiration, that's what you want, and make enough good karma, and then the chances are you'll get reborn. Ajahn Brahm, it is my understanding that one suffers and perhaps be allowed to suffer due to exhausting the negative karma. Is this not the way? That was the way of the Jain religion. They say you have to exhaust all your negative karma by experiencing extreme pain. And the Buddha, sometimes people didn't think that the Buddha had a sense of humour. In one of the suttas he did. He said, look at all these Jains standing on one leg, facing the sun all day, burning themselves, hardly eating. My goodness, they must have been murderers and rapists in their past life. Because this is the karma they have to endure now. And he said, no, the karma of your past, it is inexhaustible if you try and wear it out just by having pain. And the same as your good karma is actually inexhaustible as well. Because the way that karma works, if you do a good deed, it's like planting a mango seed. How many mangoes do you get for one seed? Now, thousands, millions in time. So one good act of kindness and you reap the reward thousands and hundreds of thousands of time. So every time I've done a good act of kindness, I get rewarded so many times back, not just one to one, just thousands of times for every act of kindness and every act of selfishness or cruelty. You get that punished many, many times, not just once, but many, many times, every time you remember it. So you can imagine in all your journeys through many, many lives, you've done such a huge amount of bad karma, like a big mountain, inexhaustible. But don't worry, you've also done a whole Himalaya mountain of good karma as well. So which are you going to choose? You know, I was mentioning that too many people are so negative, they keep choosing the bad karma. And really, you can let go of that bad karma and just choose the good karma. And a good way of doing that is every one of you has given donations, you've given robes, you've done all this amazing good karma. Why don't you make use of it? So the person who's just given this robe, every time you meditate today, before you start meditating, think, I've given a robe to a good monk. I've given a robe to a good monk. Wow, that's incredibly good merit. The very fact I had this opportunity and I did this, wow, that's amazing. And straight away you're getting inspiration, you're getting some free piti sukha to start your meditation. And then you just go off. That's why that you may know there is a custom to offer robes at the beginning of the wasa, of the rains retreat. It's called rainy season bathing cloths. And that was begun because in the time of the Buddha, some monks were actually bathing in the rain before they were going to a dana at Wasaka's house. I remember in the monsoon seasons in India, they would usually bathe in the rivers, but the rivers were swollen. They were dangerous to bathe in. There weren't any showers or bathrooms like we have these days, so there'd be neither rivers or lakes. So when it was rainy season, they just couldn't use those. So when it was a heavy rain, they just go out in the heavy rain, take off their robes, and just bathe in the rainstorm. And that's what they were doing this morning. And when Vaisakha sent her maid to invite the monks for dana, all she saw was naked men. And she turned around and said, Madam, there are no monks in that monastery, there were just perverts. You know, we didn't actually say that. But there were monks, there were people without any clothes on. And Vaisakha was very clever, and she said, go back. So she went back, and by this time the monks had finished bathing, had dressed, and then she invited them for the meal. And Vaisakha told the Buddha, he said, look, it's not nice for people to see naked monks, especially my maid. So look, if you are going to bathe in the rain during this time of the year, can you please wear a special cloth? And can I be the one who offers these cloths? to the Sangha. And while I'm at it, can I also be the one who offers the cross to the Bhikkhuni Sangha during the rainy season? And can I also, because I've noticed that many monks and nuns, they come here to Sawati for the first time, they don't know where to go an alms round, so can they always come to my house for food the very first day they come, so that at least the first day when they're getting to know the place, they know they can get a good meal? And you know, just before they leave, before the monks go walking, they may need a new pair of sandals or a new this, so can they come to my house the day when they leave, so I can also give them any sort of requisites they need for their travels? And she said, I've noticed there's many sick monks, and those sick monks, they need special food. They might go to the kitchen or to alms round, they might not got exactly what they want. So if any sick monks during this rains retreat, can they please come or send a word to my house and I'll make them special food, so it will help their sickness. And she said, you know, that there are monks who look after the sick, and they're looking after the sick so much they don't get time to get any food for themselves, so can I also supply food to the sick monks? And the Buddha said, that's asking a lot. You know, and you want to do that all by yourself and not let anybody else also do that? He said, yes. And the Buddha said, why? And that was when Visakha said, and this was, so she's an incredibly wise woman. She said, look, if you give me that opportunity to supply these cloths to every monk or nun during the rains, and I know that I would also have fed them at least once when they first came to Sawati, I will know that every monk or nun in this community who gets a jhana, or gets a stage of enlightenment, I would have given them something. I know that I would have supported them. And when I remember that that monk or nun who's got a jhana, who's got a stage of enlightenment, that I've actually given something for them, that will give me so much inspiration and happiness. And from that inspiration and happiness, she said, I will feel pity. And from pity, my body and mind will become tranquil. From tranquility, I will get this sukha, this beautiful peace in my mind. And from that sukha, my mind, my own mind, will get samadhi, will get stillness. And from stillness, I too will see things as they truly are, and I will get stages of enlightenment. And when the Buddha realized just how smart Visakha was, he said, you are a very wise woman, I will give you those privileges. Because she knew how to make use of the good karma by developing inspiration. And from that inspiration, you have this whole sequence, which you see in those books there. It occurs many, 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 many times. From inspiration we get pity, we've got this joy. From joy our body becomes tranquil, you can sit for long periods of time. And the mind becomes tranquil too, because of joy. And that gives this beautiful sukha, that bliss which you experience in meditation. And from that happy mind, that's where you get the samadhi, the stillness from. It's from happiness you get stillness. And only when the mind is still can you see things as they truly are and get the insight of enlightenment. And the Buddha taught that so many times, and when she realized that someone actually understood that, she said, you can do those wonderful gifts. She knew how to make use of the good karma. And each one of you have got huge amounts of good karma, please make use of it. So make use of it for your meditation. Inspire yourself. And then you get incredible energy. I told you, that's what I do so many times. I do get tired often, because I work very hard, I'm getting old now and I travel a lot. And whenever I get really tired and I've got to give a Dharma talk, and I told you what I do, I just sit down and remember all the good karma I've done recently. And as soon as you do that, right, get straight. Energy comes going, wow, you can really give. That's energy source. And that's actually how you make use of good karma. Bad karma, throw it away for goodness sake. Stop dwelling on it. Because you don't have to dwell on it. You can forgive it, you can let it go. It can be what they call in Buddhism ahosi karma. Karma that was. Where's it gone? I'm going to put it on the top. That's okay, never mind. So that's make use of your good karma. So you don't need to exhaust the negative karma, just throw it away. In the same way that whatever rubbish you've accumulated on this retreat, are you going to take that home with you? Or are you going to throw it in the trash can? throw it in the trash can, do you? Don't you? And any of the good things, you may have had some nice notes, some photographs, some books, some CDs or whatever, you take those home with you, don't you? You don't take, you know, the sort of the tissues you've wiped your nose with and keep that back. So you throw the bad stuff away and keep the good stuff. That's the wise person. Could you explain the walking meditation technique? What are we supposed to be mindful of? Sensation or motion? When meditation I feel giddy. Why? Okay, now first of all, the walking meditation, I've mentioned it many times. Your attention 2 meters in front. So you're looking at the ground 2 meters in front, not to the left, not to the right, not looking what other people are doing. 2 meters in front. And you find a nice path. It's not so good to have circular path. If you have a circular path, maybe that's why she gets giddy. So, a straight path, backwards and forwards. Sometimes they say 20 steps, 25, 30 steps, depending on, you know, how much you like. Backwards and forwards, nice, easy path, so you don't have to worry whether you're going to trip over a stick or any rubbish. So it's nice and clean path, easy to walk. Walk to the end, turn around, walk back again. And again, the great thing about walking meditation is you never get anywhere. You go there and you come back again. Now that's a very powerful Dhamma teaching. So you don't get anywhere. But on the way, it's not where you're getting to, it's how you're getting there. It's the most important thing about life. I'm not making any headway here. Of every question which gets answered, 2 more get in the box. So, when you're walking, it's how you're getting there. Make sure you're making peace, being kind, being gentle. Making peace, being kind, being gentle. Making peace, being kind, being gentle. What you're doing is not so important as how you're doing it in life. So in the present moment, just making peace with this walking. If you're hurting, if you're having good times, just make peace with it. Be kind. So you've been kind to your body, being kind to everything, and be very gentle. And if you want to put your attention on anything, first stage, attention on present moment. Second stage, try and shut up and be silent. Third stage, just know which foot is moving, left or right. Just like in breath, out breath. It's left foot, right foot. And the next stage is noticing more of the movement of the feet. So you know what moves up first of all. You know, just notice the different sensations of walking. At that stage, you can do noting if you wish. But after the noting has done its job, let it go and just know the movement of the feet. And that's all you need to do. Later on, that movement of the feet gets so beautiful and so lovely that you may actually get into that next stage, is where you're just walking, you're not doing it, you're just watching from a distance. And that's very nice. Please give us a update on the recently re-established Bhikkhuni ordination. Also, how do we denote the Bhikkhuni Sangha? Do you have the donation box with you? No, I don't carry donation box. Lastly, how do we respectfully address the Bhikkhuni, the female version of the term Bante? The last question, firstly, you call it Aya, or Aya. Aya is the same as Bante, but it's only for the female. So that's Aya over there. So you call them Aya, okay? Aya. Get that again? Aya? Aya, very good. That's Aya. And a Bhikkhuni ordination, we're making some inroads over there. So the Bhikkhunis are going very, very well. And we are, if you keep a look on the internet site, there's so many new candidates now want to become Bhikkhunis. And our monastery, Nuns Monastery over in Perth, is one of the best for that, because you've got good support and you've got a very nice block of land. But now we're going to be increasing the facilities over there just because of demand. So we've already started getting plans together for a new a hall for the Bhikkhunis. They've only got a small little room there for themselves, and that'll be coming up soon. So if you keep looking at our BSWA website, you'll soon see just the hall coming up there. And so obviously that I'd imagine they'll be asking for some donations for that hall. So it's coming, it's growing. And there was another Bhikkhuni ordination done in California of our tradition, so we're getting there. And you may think, oh, it's a controversial thing to do, but look, there were Bhikkhunis in the time of the Buddha. It was a fourfold Sangha, and even as a man, you realize there's something missing if we don't have the nuns. Number two, we need more teachers. And if there's only monks doing the teaching, that's, you know, half the population we're not exploiting. So it's great that we have Bhikkhunis, and hopefully in not so long they'll be sitting here teaching meditation retreats as they have done in the past. You've got Sali Dipankara. In the old days you used to have this German nun, Aya Kamer, inspiring a lot of people. So, you know, we can't afford not to have more teachers. And also it means that, you know, we realize that in Buddhism it does not matter what race, what gender, what sexual orientation, if you're homosexual or whatever, you can still be a Buddhist and you're well respected. So it's a religion which hasn't had those barriers. From the very beginning there were no barriers, and somehow some of those barriers between peoples, races, religions, races, sexual orientation, gender, sometimes those barriers have crept in over the centuries. They weren't there in the time of the Buddha. You all know one of the things the Buddha kept on criticizing was the caste system, which was in India at the time. He said, look, that caste system, if you're going to be a high caste, it doesn't matter who your father was, it's how you behave, your behavior. So it was a very wonderful meritocracy sort of religion which the Buddha taught. It doesn't matter what gender, what caste you come from, if you come from a very poor family or a wealthy family, you're treated the same. And that was an incredibly powerful statement, and so we want to try and re-establish that in our Sangha. And especially, as many of you know who have actually gone to the Western countries and studied there, you know that Buddhism will never get established in countries like the United States or Europe or Australia if there's any hint of gender discrimination. You just can't do it. People will just leave. So anyway, is it true the Buddha taught Abhidhamma to his mother in the Tusita heaven? I mentioned that yesterday. His mother actually was in the Tusita heaven, but they say he taught in the Tawadingsa heaven. But it's very unlikely that that is the case. There's one of the Abhidhamma books which is called the Patana. It's the last of the Abhidhamma books. In the book which you actually see, it's a heavily abbreviated, because it's so many different combinations. And there was one monk, he must have been a mathematician before, he worked out that if the Buddha had taught all of that Patana, it's such a long speech that a normal speech would take about 1,000 years at the normal speech of like what I'm doing now. That's actually how much information, because it's this combination after that combination. He was actually showing it's absolutely impossible that anyone could have taught that, because there was just too many combinations. Westerners are like that. They get these ideas and they start working out the combinations and seeing that, you know, a normal rate of speech, which is maybe one word every 2 or 3 seconds, then this whole text would take such a long time to recite. So even though it's our tradition that, yes, that's what they say, as a Buddhist, we must always bend our faith to fit the facts. And if the facts, the evidence is strongly against it, there is no such thing as a sacred cow in Buddhism. Even though we're many vegetarians, a sacred cow means that there's things which you cannot touch no matter what. So if there's something which doesn't make sense, any teaching which I do which doesn't make sense, don't accept it. So we've got those other teachings, even in the suttas here. They say that the Buddha was extremely tall, had these incredibly long ears, had a tongue which actually could touch his forehead, and had his marks like tattoos, you know, on his feet. You know, that was actually where the first tattoos came from, apparently, because he had his marks, his wheels on his feet, and it would always leave a mark. And if you read all of that, then, you know, this person they describe would be so exceptional, would actually almost be like, you know, one of these freaks they have in a circus. But the evidence was contrary to that, because there was many cases where the monks, there was one case I think of Pukusati, I think his name was, but I might be wrong there, that he was journeying to see the Buddha. He'd ordained with another monk, he wanted to see the Buddha, the great teacher. And on his journey, he came to a potter's shed and asked to be able to stay there the night. They said yes. And then a bit later, the Buddha came there, and he was journeying. So he asked to stay the night there, and the potter said, well, you better ask the other monk who came there first. And the other monk said, okay, you can share this place with me. And the two of them were meditating there all night. Now, this monk started meditating, so the Buddha meditated, and the monk opened his eyes and said, this monk was with me, he meditates really good, I better keep on meditating. So they both meditated all night. And in the early morning, the monk said to the Buddha, he said, "Wow, you're a very good meditator." And the Buddha said, "Actually, you're a good meditator too. Who's your teacher?" He said to this monk. And the monk said, "Oh, it was some, I forget, it was Maha something or other. Mahachundra, I think it was, but I'm not quite sure." And he said, "What are you doing?" "I'm going to visit the Buddha." And then he asked the Buddha, "Who's your teacher?" And the Buddha said, "I have no teacher, I'm the Buddha." "Ah!" "I spent all night with the Buddha. And I talked to him like that." And it was a very nice little exchange. But what comes out of that was that he didn't know who the Buddha was. He was just like an ordinary monk. So he didn't have these special physical features which would set him out from every other human being. So stories like that say that some of this stuff, even in the suttas, then must have been added afterwards, because it doesn't make any sense. So be rational. Ajahn, when we are sleepy, if we tell our mind that it can go to sleep if it wants, we may fall into a long sleep. If we let our mind to go to wherever it wants, why would the mind come back and stay with us and watch the breath? Thank you for being such an inspiring teacher. Did I tell you the story of the mother who let her 6-year-old boy leave home? Okay, this was in Perth. There was a mother with a 6-year-old boy, and the boy got very upset with his mother. And so the 6-year-old says, "Mummy, I don't love you any longer. I want to leave home." And so the mother said, "Okay, darling, I'll help you pack." So the mother and the boy went into the room and packed his suitcase with his teddy bear and favourite toys and a couple of clothes. And the mother said, "Before you go, son, I'd better make you something for lunch." So made him a couple of sandwiches. And then she waved her son at the front door of their house. "Bye-bye, son, have a wonderful life." And there the son went off into his life with some sandwiches and a little suitcase. He walked the end of the path to the gate, opened the gate, turned around, and went to the end of the road, and by that time was totally homesick, turned around, came into the gate, and his mother was still waiting at the door to greet him back. "Welcome home, son." There was the counsellor of the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore. She was meditating at my monastery in Perth when I told her that story. And she was totally disrespectful. She was holding her belly, rolling on the floor, laughing her head off. And I said, "What are you doing?" And she said, "You wouldn't believe this, Ajahn Brahm. When I was 6, I did the same thing. I really got upset at my mummy. And I said, 'Mummy, I'm leaving home.' And she too helped me pack my bag, but she didn't give me any sandwiches." It was Singapore. She gave me $20 and said, "Buy your own lunch." And so there I went, you know, in the HBD block of flats of apartments. I went into the elevator. My mum was on the other side. She waved me off. "Have a wonderful life, daughter." And so I went down to the bottom floor. And even by the time we got to the bottom floor, I missed my mummy so much. I pressed the button where my house was, and I went up there, and as the doors of the lift opened, there was my mother. "Welcome back, darling." Now that was really good psychologists. Sometimes mothers, they know their children. They know their children might want to leave, but they can't go that far. They'll come back, just like your mind. "Bye-bye, mind. Have a wonderful life. Go and wander off in sexual fantasies. Go to sleep. Go and plan your future. Bye-bye, mind. Have a lovely time. You pack its bags, give it $20 and send it off. It won't be long before it gets so homesick it will come back to you." That's the way your mind works. So you can let it go. "Bye-bye. Have a nice time." And because you're nice to your mind and friendly with it, it'll always come back to you. But if you say, "I'm not going to let you go, I'm not going to let you go," then when your mind does go, it goes a long way before it comes back. Be kind to it, and it'll always come back to you. Which is what I said early on. If you're kind to your mind, if you're such a good friend to it, of course it would always like to be with you. The only reason it wanders off a lot and stays away is because your relationship you've got with your own mind is not very good. You've been treating it like a slave, beating it when it doesn't do what you want, scolding it instead of praising your mind. Thank you so much, mind, for coming back. I really like you, mind. I miss you when you're going off into sexual fantasies and going to sleep. But if that's what you need to do, fine. But come back and then we can spend some good time together meditating. That works. That's no joke. According to some traditions, persons who have been following the Maitreya practice will be going to Tushita to heaven upon their death. Where is this Tushita to heaven? What's the difference between a Tushita to heaven in comparison with Western Pure Land and Nibbana? Thank you for clarification with method. That's where they say once returners mostly go to the Tusita realm. And the Tusita realm is like the two-seater car. Seat over here and seat over there. Two-seater. but really, like all these heaven realms, they're mind-made. They're all manomayakaya, mind-made bodies. So you make those heaven realms. If you look at the description of those heaven realms in the suttas, they are so passé. They are so old-fashioned. In those heavens, they live in castles with turrets, with heavenly musicians playing sort of like lutes and guitars. No, in modern day heavens, they have electric guitars and rock bands. They don't live in castles, they live in air-conditioned condos. Why is that? Because you design your own heaven. You make it for what you feel you deserve. It's incredible to understand that. Even your hells, if you go to a hell realm, it's not just being in a pot of boiling oil, being poked by these goggly-eyed demons with these sharp forks. The science of torture has come a long way since those days. So if you want to go to a hell realm, your hell realm will be totally different than you see on the temple paintings. You will create your own hell. Because of guilt, because you feel you need to be punished, and you will create as much punishment as you need until you can forgive yourself. The gates of hell are always open to anyone who has a compassionate thought to forgive themselves. Well, one of the times I got that insight was when I went to Borobudur. And there's a really, really nice Indonesian monk, Sri Panyawara, who lives in Wihara Mendut, which is really close by. And because he was a good friend, you know, he put me up in Wihara Mendut and gave me the expert's guided tour of Borobudur. And I always remember at the base of Borobudur, that's where they have the hell realms. And he was pointing out just one of the carvings on the bottom of this young man who made a fortune, lost a fortune. And one day he was just so frustrated he hit his mother and she fell over. And because of the karmic consequence of being that cruel to your own mother, he was reborn in this hell realm. And he went into this hell realm and there he saw, the first person he saw was a man who was having his brain cut with this razor sharp wheel. Now if you had a headache or migraine before, this is like a migraine times 100. And he was in agony. But when he saw this new guy come, he said, at last, I've been down here for 500 years, suffering this agony because I hurt my mother. And I was told in 500 years' time, another man will come who has also hurt his mother, and this razor wheel will go from me into his head. Here it is. And so the razor wheel fell away from the guy who had been tortured for 500 years, and he was free, and went into this new guy. And this new guy was experiencing such agony, having his head cut with a razor wheel. And then he had a moment of compassion. He said, it's a terrible thing which I have done, and it's an even worse punishment I'm receiving. I don't want this to happen to anybody else, so I will take another 2,000 years. For the next four people after me who hurt their mother, I will take their punishment for them. And with just that little act of compassion, the razor wheel exploded, disintegrated, and he was reborn in the heaven realm. And that was the old story, and that is accurate Buddhist psychology. A little bit of compassion and you cannot stay in the hell realm. It's mind made, the hell realm. It can only exist with a negative mind state. Forgiveness, compassion, kindness to others, and hell for you explodes and disintegrates. These are mind made realms. So if you've been really practicing Maitreya, which is loving kindness, of course you'll be reborn in great places. The Tushita heaven is one of those places. Now what's the difference between the West and Pure Land? Again, it's no such thing as in the West. The Tushita heaven is a mind-made realm. It doesn't live in this universe, so you can't go to it with an aircraft or with a train and get to that Western land. No, this is actually just a mind-made realm. And Nibbana is no realm at all. The end of all realms. Gone, finished. Poof. Even being forgiven or forgive others, the karma created will still ripen in future under the right condition. Please correct me if this is not true. Sometimes it doesn't ripen. To be able to ripen, you have to have the causes for these old karma to ripen. And if you're very wise, you can cut off those causes. So old karma actually does not ripen. And of course, the way really to do that is to become a stream winner. When you really understand how this mind works, and understand there's nobody in here, there's no self, no will. There is will there, but it doesn't come from me. It's not sort of personally driven. If you can do things like that, as you all know from those texts, the Buddha said there's no more possibility of rebirth in the hell realms, in the ghost realms, in the animal realms. All those realms are closed to you from now on. So you can end old karma without needing to experience its results. In the same way Angulimala did. The karma he did for killing so many people was huge. Yeah. And most of that he just totally cut off. He never needed to re-experience it. So it can be done. Does the repentance, chanting or purification practice such as in Chinese Mahayana or Vajrayana help reduce karma? If yes, how does this actually work? Again, if it really is repentance, in other words, you see you've done something wrong, but not punishment. Repentance doesn't mean punishment, it means admitting, I made a mistake, I shouldn't have done that. But once you have the repentance, you're admitting your mistake, the next stage has to be, how can I make sure I never do that again? So that's where one starts to think of strategies, training yourself. So it's not just forgiving yourself, it's learning. Learning what you did wrong, why you did that, and make sure you never do that again. It's what we call in the penal system rehabilitation rather than punishment. And every psychologist knows that in the criminal systems of all our modern countries, when we go into a punishment system where we put people in jail or we punish them for their crimes, it does not work. It has never worked. Rehabilitation is the only way which truly works. They will be building more jails in Malaysia as they always do in other countries until we realize that much of crime is like a sickness and should be treated in the same way we treat, say, H1N1 or dengue. It's an illness of the ethical mind which needs to be treated, not punished, until we can really encourage people to see how stupid it was to have stolen, to have hurt another being. What do you do that for? Now make sure you never ever have to do that again. That's rehabilitative justice rather than recriminatory justice. My auntie has a son who is a drug addict. He's been sent to rehabilitation center but back to the habit again. He had stolen some valuable things from house to sell. My auntie moved her house without informing him so he won't disturb them. How can I help? Thank you, thank you, thank you. Number one, to actually take the fellow away from his friends, because what usually happens, you can put a person in some rehab program for drugs, but as soon as he comes out again, his friends target him and are selling him drugs again, and he goes back to the same place he began. So there's many, many rehab programs which actually can get his addiction to that drug off, out of him for a little while. But then once he comes out of that rehab problem, you have to somehow move him away. Sometimes people move them away to a different country. So he's got totally different friends, a new environment, a new chance to start. And also, a lot of times the reason why people take drugs or alcohol addictions, they have incredibly low self-esteem. They've got nothing really to live for. And so they just kill their own body and they drug their mind so they don't feel the pain of their existence. So they also need, if you really want to get them going, new country, new life, and a lot of stimulation and inspiration about how they can live a positive life, which is usually where the religion comes in. So rehab, move to a new country and get them a very strong spiritual core. So if they're a Buddhist or a Christian or a Muslim or whatever, get them really inspired by their faith, by their path. Give them really something to live for, much more self-esteem, and there's a good chance they will get out of that drug problem. It takes a huge amount of resources, but if you don't give those resources at the beginning, they end up like stealing and taking your money, and all your life savings can very easily disappear. It's a very, very, very big problem. Ajahn, after seeing the yellow colour light, then the background eventually turns into a white screen. No more block surroundings. Is this still with Nimitta stage? Yes, it is. Let it develop and just see what happens. And so it can be very fascinating how it happens. But the most important thing is your Nimitta, doesn't matter what colour it is, what shape it is, the most important thing with Nimitta is, number one, it stabilises. So it stops changing backwards and forwards. And number two, it becomes incredibly beautiful and brilliant. So the brilliance of the Nimitta, its beauty, its bliss, it's all the same word describing the same event, and its stability. It is why in the Anapanasati Sutta, it tells you to Abhipamojayang Jitang and Samadahang Jitang. Abhipamojayang Jitang, which literally means brightening up, I call it shining the Nimitta, making it incredibly beautiful. And you usually do that by leaving it alone, just having a positive mind. And the second is for Samadahang Jitang, keeping it still. Again, that's just realizing that you, the watcher, are the one who moves. You, the watcher, have to be still. If the one watching is still, the reflection, which is a Nimitta, is also still. So that's what one has to do. Thank you for your compassion and teachings. When does one change the object of meditation? You don't. You just sit there and the object changes itself. Just like, you know, just I'm looking out the window of the aircraft. When do I have to change from looking at Malaysia to looking at Singapore to looking at Indonesia to looking at Australia? I just look there and just it changes by itself. So you do nothing. You are the observer. You are not the back seat driver. Come on, mind, hurry up. I've only got a few hours left before I go home. I've got to get in line quick. Don't be the backseat driver, just let it happen. After many years of using breath as the object, I have not progressed at all. Should I change to another object? You never progress, you ingress. So you don't go on to another object, you go into it. And the reason why to change to another object, it does not matter what object of meditation you are watching, it's how you're watching it. Remember the second factor of the Eightfold Path, which I mentioned on the first talk. Second factor of the Eightfold Path, if you want to get to Nibbana, you've got to remember all those eight factors of the Eightfold Path. And number two is having intentions, what's driving your mind or driving your meditation, intentions of letting go, kindness and gentleness. And if your meditation is not progressing, it means your intention is wrong. Instead of letting go, you're trying to get something. That is wrong intention, Michcha Sankalpa. You've lost the Eightfold Path. If you are being forceful, it's not metta. It becomes vyapada sankalpa. In other words, wrong intention again. And if it's aggressive, it's not ahimsaka sankalpa, which is the third of the right intentions. Of all those intentions, people know ahimsaka because Mahatma Gandhi made that word famous. Ahimsa, non-violence. But the Buddha used that word centuries before as the third of the right intentions. Gentleness, non-violence. So if you're, whatever meditation object you are watching, make sure that you are also watching it with right intention. The intention of letting go, renouncing, nekama. With intentions of kindness, of metta. With intentions of non-violence or gentleness. Then you'll find you may understand why you haven't actually experienced what you think is progress. You're watching the right objects, but not with the right intention. It is said that the last moment thought will determine where we are reborn to. In Mahayana, it's believed by reciting Amitofa, a person will go to pure land and will not get reborn again. So can we combine both meditation and recital Amitofa? How to let a free thinker to die peacefully? A free thinker is a person who keeps thinking so freely they never get any peace and quiet at all. I prefer a no thinker than a free thinker. But what a free thinker means is the one who's always questioning. And if you really are a free thinker, you're a Buddhist. Because Buddhist is all about free thinking. So anyone, any of your friends who say, I'm a free thinker, you say, oh, sadhu, sadhu, I'm a free thinker, too, I'm a Buddhist. Just confuse them a bit. And it really doesn't matter if you are reciting Amitofa at the end of your life. It depends actually what you mean by Amitofa. If it really is inspiring you, creating a lot of peace in your mind, then okay. Thank you, Ajahn, for the sharing and guidance and teachings. Get well soon. I've got well. So, and it's very soon. Sadhu 3, Merry Christmas and safe journey. Sugihota. Yeah, I'm fine. I've recovered. I told you at the very beginning what my teacher said. You either get better or you die. And I didn't die, so I must have got better. Dear Ajahn, I'd like to put a Buddha statue in my living dining room, but I live in an apartment. Is it appropriate to do so? As a layperson, we watch television and occasionally have arguments with our family members. Would this be disrespectful, as Buddha statues are usually placed in quiet and serene places, like the Shrine Hall? Thank you. No, it's even more important to have it in places where you argue. The Buddha loves going to such places so he can actually give some compassion. What's the use of a Buddha being in a place where people are all good and happy and serene and peaceful? No, the Buddha needs to go into your bathroom or bedroom or wherever there's an argument or wherever there's problems. And that means you're about to have an argument and see the Buddha and think, oh, I can't do it. But don't do like some people do. They've got a Buddha in their apartment. Before they have an argument, they put a cloth over it. That's all they can go for it. That's a good thing to do that. So great, have a Buddha statue in your apartment. It just reminds you of peace and quiet. And it's not disrespectful at all. So do so. That's why you know that... You know who had a Buddha statue next to his bed? Throughout the whole Second World War, Winston Churchill. He had a Burmese Buddha statue. And we only know that one of my monks was visiting England. He was an Australian. The first time he'd been to England, and so his host decided to show him an English castle. You know, if you lived in Australia, you don't have any castles over there, just like in Malaysia. So when you go over to England, what do? You go and see an old castle, because it's interesting. Unfortunately, that day the castle was closed. So his host thought, my goodness, I should have checked this out. Where else should I go? And so quite close by was the home of the British Prime Minister, Winston Churchill. So do you want to see his home? I said, okay, might as well. And when they went into the door of this home, had to pay a fee, on the wall was one of Winston Churchill's paintings, which was of a Buddha statue. And of course the monk said, what's that doing there? That's a Buddha statue. I thought Winston Churchill was a Christian. And the curator said, that's a painting which Winston Churchill did himself, of this statue which got lost after the Second World War, which was by his bedside throughout the Second World War, to give him a sense of peace and hope in the darkest days of that conflict. Did you know that? And did you know what his wife Clementine had on her bedside table? A statue of Kuan Yin. It's true. Check it out. So why did he have that? Because even for a British Prime Minister, a statue of Buddha was a statue of peace and hope. And many, many people, if you go to places like Australia, the most common ornament in people's gardens is a Buddha statue.
They have that there because it gives them a sense of tranquility and peace in their busy lives. Even though they're not Buddhists, and they ask me, is it okay? So of course it's okay, because it's doing a job for you. It's creating a sense of peace in your busy lives. Have it there. So, amazing, the power of a Buddha statue. How long can a jhana last? If you enter the jhana after you die, it usually can last about, what was it, 100 eons, I think. Was it 50 eons, first jhana? So that's a long, long time. It's about 50 eons. And I told you what an eon is. So roughly about, that's 13,500 million years. So that's a pretty long time. However, if you're still alive, the jhana can last. Okay, I'll tell you this. Some of you heard this story. But very recently, there was a Vietnamese monk who went to teach a retreat in Australia. And just like when I taught a retreat here, actually the first day, it didn't have any public talks, so the first day on a Friday evening they did like a half an hour meditation first, and then he was going to give the opening talk, the 8 precepts. But when it came to the time of the talk, he hadn't come out of his meditation yet. So 8:30, he still hadn't come out, and they were waiting for the talk. 9:00, he still hadn't come out. 9:30, and they all went to bed. He didn't give the talk that evening. They got up the following morning at 5:00, and he was still sitting there, hadn't moved all night. He didn't move for the whole 8.5 days, I think. Just sat there, didn't give any talk at all. That's a monk, that's a real monk. And at the end of coming out of meditation, he apologized. He said, I'm really, really sorry that I got into a sort of deep meditation and time just disappeared. I'm sorry I didn't give any talks. And I said, sadhu, 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 you don't have to give a talk. That's the most impressive thing we've ever seen, that monks can actually do that today. Sadhu, 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 you've inspired all of us. So that's what you can do. Sit here and you'll still be here this time next week. Dear Ajahn, I'm an organ donor. I will give all my organs to people when I die. A best friend of mine. What would happen actually if I gave my brain? I'm an organ donor too. So suppose that they transferred my brain, say into Eng Chai's brain. Now would that mean that after the brain transplant is finished, that Eng Chai would be able to give funny Dhamma talks? Be interesting, wouldn't it? When he came to, would he be Brother Eng Chai or would he be Ajahn Brahm? No, he'd be Eng Chai. Because your brain is not the person. So even if you transfer the brain, you're not transferring the person. So he'd still be Eng Chai. So anyway, I'll give all my organs to people when I die. A best friend of mine, also a Buddhist meditator, told her mum, do not allow and approve her to do so, as in Chinese some believe we have to die in one whole complete peace. Can you share your thoughts? And I just wish more people know this is untrue and become an organ donor. Exactly. That if you are an organ donor and your mum stops you, your mum has made bad karma. She may have killed many, many people, because those people would have been saved by your organs. So you tell your mum, if you stop me giving my organs, you will be the responsible for the death and pain of many people. Is that what you really want? As for me, I've got it on higher authority. Monks like Ajahn Brahm said if I give my organs, that I will get a much better rebirth as well. I will not lose out by this. Now I'm being quite fierce there, because I agree with the questioner here. It's a great tragedy that people have these superstitious beliefs which are not true. If you give your organs when you die, if you go to a heaven realm and you say you've given your eyes, you'll have 3 or 4 eyes in heaven. And for your next 100 births, you will never have to wear glasses like I do. You'll get huge benefits. So obviously it's karma, it's good karma, you're giving to help ease other people's suffering.
that is always good karma. And when you die, you'll be inspired that you, your last act of generosity and kindness is right when you die, to giving your organs to save the suffering of so many people. And you tell your mum that. And ask your mum, sort of, when you get kidney failure, do you want an organ? Do you want to have the benefit of somebody else's organ so that you can survive? If me, your daughter, if I have kidney failure, would you just let me die, or would you go seeking an organ for me? So if you don't allow me to give, how can anyone receive? So, and this is recorded, so you can get this on the recording and show it to your mum. I have a 4.5-year-old daughter. Recently my mother passed on, and my daughter has been asking me the following question: where is grandma now? You tell her that she's died, and she's probably got reborn by now, 4.5 years. Is grandma alive? Yes, she's always alive, but in a new body. Just like, you know, sometimes you had our old car and that wore out, so now we've got a new car. Does grandma wake up in the morning and walk around like us? Depends where she's been reborn. She may have been out 4.5 years, be a little baby, even younger than you. And so maybe she doesn't walk around now, but she's crawling around. I find these questions difficult to answer. I do not know the answers. At the same time, I do not want to lie to her. I hope Ajahn can help guide me. I think I've given the answers there. Hi Ajahn Brahm, the Mahayana Buddhists chant Kuan Yin and Amitabha beside praying to the Buddha. Is this in the teaching of the Buddha, and does the Pure Land exist? By the way, thanks for your inspiring talks for the past week. I learned a lot from you. Remember that the Pure Land is a heaven realm. It's a mind-made realm. If you believe it, you create it. So say, does it exist or not? Now, whatever you believe in, you create. You can make it exist. In the same way, your hell realms, if you go to hell realm, it's personalized just for you. Your heaven realms are personalized just for you. If you understand just how powerful the mind is, it is the creator. You will create that world for yourself. Ajahn, is it true that humans get benefit from devas when in trouble? Some do. Depends why you're in trouble. If you are in trouble because you've gone to the casino and spent all your money, the devas are not going to help you. It's your fault. Stupid. But if, say, you're going to the temple, and you're going to the temple and you're in trouble because, you know, you may have... like this one lady, she was going to the temple, my temple over in Australia, and her business, she got this order in the day before, so she had to work all night packing up the order so she could consign it the following morning. So really she should have just taken the morning off, but she promised that she'd come to the temple the following day. And she was such a devout Buddhist, if I make such a promise to go to the monastery, I have to come no matter how tired I am. So she quickly brought some food rather than making herself, got in her car and started driving to the temple. And of course she fell asleep at the wheel. And she said she was alone in the car, just her, and someone slapped her across the face. Enough to wake up, she found she drifted in the oncoming lane and there was a big truck coming towards her. She managed to turn the steering wheel to avoid a fatal head-on collision. She said it happened 2 more times. Once she was actually drifting off to the side of the road. Another slap. And she realized that something was helping her, keeping her alive. And I told her, yes, that would have been a deva protecting you because you were coming to a monastery. But if you were going to the casino, the deva would have let you have the head-on collision. So only if you're doing something good, the deva will help out. In Tibetan Buddhism, some believe that using the dying technique or powa could help the reincarnation to a higher place. It's exactly the same which we're teaching here. That powa technique is just from people, especially monks, who remember how to die, because they've died many, many times. And they give the instructions, you know, I give it in my own words to make it relevant to each one of you. If you've died before, if you know exactly what happens in the dying process, you know exactly what to do. It's exactly what you're doing in the meditation technique. I can just tell you, just that when you're dying, be kind, no, let go. No, be kind, be gentle, don't fight the process. And just remember, just let go, let go, let go. And if you learn how to let go in this life, you know how difficult it is to let go even now. So practice your letting go, because when you die, you really have to let go big time. You have to let go of your family, your wealth, everything. You can't take anything, as you know, with you. So you have to learn how to let go now. This is training in dying, this retreat. And when you know how to let go and get into deep meditation, then you're sweet when you die. It's very easy to die. And all those techniques you've actually learned before you die. So it really helps. Why do you raise your class fans higher and higher when you say sadhu? They asked that question last time. This is the first time I'm seeing a monk doing this, and I do find this very interesting indeed. So my teacher Ajahn Chah said, whatever you do in life, give it everything you've got. Don't do things half-hearted. So if you're meditating, give it everything you've got. If you're sleeping, sleep well. Now, if you're playing, in other words, you're having fun in your lay life, give it everything you've got. And even like these sadhus, you can see the effect of when I do these three over-the-top sadhus. It makes people happy. They smile. They get some joy and energy. That's why. And instead, you know, the other three sadhus, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's really depressing. And is that how you worship a Buddha? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. No, be exuberant, enthusiastic. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. It's the Buddha. So that's actually why I do that, to give a bit more energy into people's practice. I want to thank you so much for your guidance and time here in Malaysia. One of the amazing discoveries I had in this retreat is compassion. Wow. You see, I realized all my problems in life is the lack of compassion I have. That's absolutely brilliant. A question like that makes me coming to Malaysia worthwhile. Remember, not just sadhu, sadhu. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu! Because I understand where you're coming from and just how true that is. In this retreat, I struggled so much just to get silence. Then when I gave up and decided to do metta meditation this morning, poof, I got into silence so naturally and had a blissful time. You're absolutely right. Right mixture of mindfulness and compassion. Can this really build my compassion in the real world? What else can I do? You're doing absolutely perfect, 100%, straight A's I give you for this meditation retreat. I don't care what experience you have, but I want you to learn just not sort of what it's like when you get into deep meditation, but how to meditate. So when I leave here, you know how to continue. And sometimes people think they are compassionate, but you can't be compassionate enough. Have a bit more compassion, and a bit more compassion. You'll find it's incredible just how that changes your whole life and the life of everyone around you, especially your meditation. Buddhists are very compassionate to others, but they're not compassionate enough to themselves, which is a problem. I'm a public speaker, and I know it is a great platform to change life. What is your advice for being a better, more inspiring presenter or public speaker? Obviously, practice makes perfect. Number two, never plan what you're going to say, because if you plan what you're going to say, you're saying one thing and people want something different. So I always scan the audience when I'm speaking to make sure that I get feedback, instant feedback. If I'm not doing the right thing, you're looking down on the floor, you're looking at your watch, you're SMSing. And if that's the case, then I'm obviously not connecting, I'm wasting my time and wasting your time. And number two, you keep it not on the theoretical about sort of the 25 factors of this or the 6 factors of that, because if you want to hear the theory, you can always read it for yourselves in the book. You want to find out people's experience and how that theory translates into real life. So, keep it with stories from real life and keep it inspiring as well. The other thing about a public speaker is you never talk in a monotone, and you never sort of do a speaking from notes because you're looking at this instead of looking at the people. Always change the modulation of your voice. And actually that really engages people. And every now and again, say something loud, because that really gets people awake. So when I give stories like that story I gave about the burglar going into the monastery, I have great fun acting it out and you have great fun listening. So that's how you do public speaking. I was
His research work on stem cells, animal cell assays, as well as biologics manufacturing using animal cells considered as killing and should not be pursued by the five precepts observer. Know that stem cell research is perfectly okay because that is taken from a line of cells which haven't really qualified as being a human life. And also it does help sort of ease and cure many, many, many illnesses. And of course, stem cell research is just in its infancy. And it's amazing just what that stem cell research can do to lessen human suffering. You know, it's either coming from umbilical cords or fertilized eggs, which are not yet human, so you can't really call that human life. The Buddha said that human life begins when consciousness first manifests in that fetus in the mother's womb. There's no way you can actually say that a stem cell is conscious in any meaningful way. In other words, it cannot be manifest. It doesn't respond to pleasure or pain as we know it. So it does not qualify as a human being. So you can use that stem cell, research it. Sometimes it means destroying one cell or extracting some of it out to put into another cell, whatever. Perfectly legitimate. In fact, it's compassionate and I encourage it. There is a saying, when a person is dying, he will be able to see the dead one. People who have already passed away. Is this true? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Sometimes a dead person may be waiting for you just to show you the way. Just like, you know, when you go to university, sometimes in the orientation day, there are students who have already been to university 1 or 2 years. Come and see you and show you the ropes and where to go and what to do. So this is just like orientation after you've died. A friend often complains that he sees spirits and ghosts and sometimes dark shadows. You should have said this last night so I could have turned the lights off. Especially at night. They seem to be walking, but their feet do not touch the ground. That's a sign, isn't it? It's amazing, actually, that there are many ghosts which you see and you don't recognize it. Because they look just like the person sitting next to you. You don't really know. What is this? Oh, this is one of the most amazing ghost stories which I've ever heard and read about. This was actually the girl who married a ghost. It's a true story in Australia. There's this couple of Australians were getting married. And it was a custom in Australia that when you get married, the groom is always at the altar first, maybe 10 or 15 minutes before the ceremony begins, with the best man. And the bride always arrives 5 minutes late. She actually times it to make sure she arrives. So if the wedding's at 3 p.m, she arrives at 5 minutes past 3 p.m. It's just tradition. You know, just make sure the guy doesn't get the wrong idea that she's too keen. She is, obviously. So there, the bride arrived 5 minutes late, as programmed, as expected. But the groom, the boy, hadn't arrived yet. So she was waiting for him, and no one had seen him. And when half an hour went past, she started to get very worried. Because it is very well known that sometimes the men, they get last minute nerves, and they just don't want to go through with it. So she really thought she would be dumped at the altar. Which happens, apparently. And imagine how relieved she was when she saw him running towards the church. It was him. But she realized soon why he was late. Because, you know, the suit, his wedding suit, was all dirty and torn, and he had blood on his face. He'd been in a car accident on the way to the church. And he looked so bad, she said, "Look, forget about the wedding, I'm taking you to a hospital." He said, "No, like, I'm okay." He said, no, look, this is my wedding. I want to go through with this. I just go to the washroom and clean up, and then we'll go through with it. I feel okay." And so he went to the washroom, you know, cleaned up a little bit, and they went through the ceremony. They got married. They exchanged rings. They kissed. "You may now kiss the bride." They signed the book. They threw the confetti over everybody. They shook hands and hugged. And then the two of them got in the car to go to the reception. Just the two of them together, to spend time together before they had this big reception. The rest of the wedding party followed behind.
The rest of the wedding party caught up with the lead car because the girl was standing outside. The car parked, sobbing hysterically. They stopped and asked what had happened and where's the groom, where's the boy? She said she was driving down the road. She was driving because she thought he was still a bit shaky. She was driving, he was in the passenger seat, and they got to this point in the road and he vanished. He disappeared into thin air. And she was hysterical. When they checked later, at that very spot, a couple of hours later, he had had a fatal car collision. His body was in the morgue. That was the place he died. But he wanted to go through with that wedding so much. He created that body, a ghost body, enough to go through the whole ceremony, and she did not know. Kiss, exchange rings, sign the book, but he was a ghost. It was a girl who kissed a ghost. Be careful the next time you kiss a guy. That's a true story. It's amazing that he managed to get a solid enough body to go through with all of that. It's weird. But they say that usually, now he wasn't actually floating above the ground, but sometimes they do. So not always. Sometimes they just float and move around. Once in a while they would be very noisy and talk very loudly in a strange language we could not understand. Who are these spirits, ghosts? Why do some people have the ability to see them? Sometimes some people are actually schizo, they're not actually really seeing these things, they're just imagining them, and that's most of the time. However, that sometimes actually you do see real ghosts, but most of the time it's because it's a very strong connection. In other words, that you know, it's somebody you love very much, a father, a grandfather, a friend or something. When there's a connection, there's more likelihood you can see them. But the type of people who can actually see any ghosts, they're very few and far between. Aborted fetuses and babies born stillbirth, do these have souls and do they get to be reborn as humans again? Is this their karma? If aborted fetuses and stillbirth, especially stillborn kids, that sometimes an accident happens just when they're about to be reborn, and I say it's very, very similar. This is a simile, but it's actually accurate. It's if you go to the airport, you're flying off to, say, New York, and you find your airline has overbooked the flight, and so you get bumped off. They say, sorry sir, there's no seat available today, even though you booked a flight. You almost get on board, but you don't quite. And what does that airline do to you? They give you a nice hotel for the night, and then you get the next available flight and a free upgrade. So that's what happens if you get stillborn. You get the next available womb plus an upgrade. Which means, you know, that you actually just get the front of the queue for the next birth. And very often in the next same families, one of my disciples over there, when she got pregnant for the first time, their first child, they were so excited, but unfortunately, even with the ultrasound a few days before birth, the baby turned in the womb and strangled itself on the cord, so it was stillborn. Called Charlie. I went to the funeral service. It was a very sweet funeral service. Because they were good Buddhists, they never felt sad. And they had little Charlie in his coffin. They lent it up vertically and they took a family photograph with me in it. With Charlie. He just managed to get into the family album before it was cremated. But while I was looking the other way, they did something which is very common in Thailand. While I wasn't looking, they got out a biro pen and they did a line on the baby's heel. Just one line of blue ink on the heel. Because tradition is that if that baby comes back, he will have that as a birthmark. She was a perfectly healthy mother, so about 10-12 months later she gave birth to another child. This time totally successful. It was actually a girl this time. Time before a boy. The girl was called Anne. She's got a birthmark on her heel. A line. It was Charlie from the birth before, now got reborn as a girl. And because I saw her grow up, she was a tomboy. She hung out with the boys and she acted like a boy. And the reason was because she was a boy before. Now she was a girl. So this is what sometimes happens. They do actually get a preference for the next possible birth.
Hungry ghosts, they actually exist. Why are they so called? They really eat the food provided to up by us during Hungry Ghost Festival. Why do they get reborn as hungry ghosts? It's usually actually the dogs eat the food which you put out for the Hungry Ghost Festival, so at least you're feeding some animals and making them sort of okay. But the ghosts, they sometimes are their hungry ghosts because they haven't got enough good karma. Feeding them is sort of okay, but the best thing to do is to give them enough, share enough merits with them, they don't have to be hungry ghosts anymore. So the best thing to do in the Hungry Ghost Festival, you can put food out for them, that's a nice gesture, but the most important thing, transfer merits. So they can go from the Hungry Ghost realm to another much better rebirth. Thank you for being such a wonderful teacher. What's your advice for a couple from different religions in children upbringing? Bring them to the church or to the temple? In case, if you suggest bring them to both, would it confuse them? This is what my predecessor Ajahn Jacko said to a couple who were asking the same question. He was an Italian Catholic, she was a Thai Buddhist. What should we do with our kids? And he told them, on Saturday both of you come to the temple, on Sunday both of you go to church. In other words, so that you do things together, which is important in a marriage. And if it's a decent church, you know, they would actually say some wise things, so that, you know, you as a Buddhist can actually learn some of the wise ideas from Christianity, and you as a Christian can come and listen to some of the wise ideas of a Buddhist. So come to both, and they did. Only for a while though, and after a while I think he got fed up with going to church and they both come to temple now. You know, one of the advantages of coming to a temple is in some of these churches you have to give 10% of your income pre-tax. And when they come to the temple and realize it's for free, they prefer the temple. Tibetan believes that we can only touch the deceased upper part, any part above the heart, when people die. Then they will go to the upper realm. If we touch the lower part, then the chance of the deceased going to the lower realm is higher. Is this the only the Tibetan culture? Is there any study on this? Again, that is, with all respect to Tibetan culture, that is superstition. Because by that time they can't feel you if you touch them. They're hanging around, they can see what you're up to, and as long as you respect them and teach them and are kind to them, that's what makes them happy. So you can touch any part of the body, and of course you can give organs as well. Ajahn, I'm getting training to be a hospice volunteer to talk to people who cannot cope with the sadness they lost their loved ones and comfort them. I'm not sure if it sounds ironic to them that death is beautiful, especially if they're not Buddhist and very depressed. Can you give us some suggestions? Thank you so much, Ajahn. I'm going to get depressed now. Okay, anyway, I'll try my best. Are you okay carrying on with questions? Okay, very good. So if you're a hospice worker, obviously you have to be very careful not to impinge upon people's religious or cultural beliefs. So that's one of the first things to do, is actually find out what the religion is taught to them, so you can relate to them. And so you start where they are, and if they're very, very sad, just try and make them less sad. Don't make them feel guilty for being sad. Even if they're a Buddhist, sometimes I go up to them and tell them the story of the concert, and that makes them feel even more depressed that they're bad Buddhists, as well as, you know, trying to cope with their grief. So as my teacher Ajahn Chah used to say, talk to the person, don't talk to the belief. In other words, you know, see the person, see how you can help them, start talking with them, and see without any plans how you can lead them out of their grief into a more positive attitude. Sometimes you just can't do that. They don't want to get out of their grief, which means you just have to leave them there. But you try your very best, respecting their beliefs and respecting their religions, and try and see how you can lessen their pain, if at all possible. What is your advice for duration time we allocate aside per day for meditation? A rule of thumb is, see how many minutes every day you spend eating and spend the same amount of time meditating. So if you spend a couple of hours every day eating, a couple of hours meditating. If you can find the time to eat, you should be able to find the time to meditate. How come you can find the time to eat? Because it's fun, you enjoy it. When you enjoy meditation,
is called food for the heart, food for the mind. And the ordinary food is just food for your body, so you need both. Is jhana stage similar stage to the near-death experience? Yeah, it is very. I've said much about that. Because the jhana stage is where you let go of the body and your five senses disappear. They turn off. And that's obviously the similarity between death. Your five senses turn off at death because your brain dies and you let go of your body. And that's why that you know you experience this incredible bliss when you die, and also in nimitta stage, and you see this beautiful light when you die, just as you do in nimittas. And for those of you who've seen a nimitta, now you'll recognize that light when you die. Say, ah, I know what this is. Just like Ajahn Glam said, it's the nimitta, it's the manifestation of the mind free from the body, and you'll have much more understanding of what to do when you die. I realize that I normally don't pay homage to the Buddha at home, but every time I want to enter a meditation hall in the temple, I bow first before I meditate. That's funny, isn't it? Could you please explain the meaning of bowing three times to the Buddha again? When I bow to the Buddha, it's only a statue that's made of clay. There's no soul or no God inside of it. So if you bow to that Buddha statue and ask, may I win the lottery, may I win the lottery, may I win the lottery, the Buddha will never answer you. So you don't pray for things from the Buddha. What you do when I bow to a Buddha, I remember what the Buddha symbolizes for me. And for me, the Buddha symbolizes virtue, peace, and compassion. Sometimes wisdom instead of compassion. So when I first bow to the Buddha, I bow to virtue and goodness, not harming people, not harming yourself. And I worship virtue because I've practiced virtue in my life for such a long time now, and it gives an enormous amount of happiness. And I encourage virtue and precepts in others because it creates such peace and harmony and prosperity in our world. So when I first bow to the Buddha, I bow to virtue because I worship virtue. And then I bow to peace. This world peace, peace in a family, and especially peace of mind in the great stillness of meditation. And that's blissful. And I worship that. So I remember peace. And lastly, I worship compassion. Because this is what the Buddha symbolizes for me, virtue, peace, and compassion. So when I do that, and I'm bowing to virtue, peace, and compassion, every time I bow, I'm remembering those qualities, so they actually grow in me. That's not more questions, is it? You had me worried there. Can you tell us again the part of the sutra that mentions it's good to attach to the happiness of meditation? Thank you. Can I get it out, please? The Digha Nikaya Pasadika Sutta. It's the dialogues of the Buddha. That may be number 2. Yeah. I think it's probably number 2 there. Pasadika Sutta. I'll read it out for you. Just hold on for a moment. This is the old translation. It's a much better translation these days, which is done by Maurice Walsh from England. I'll just find it for you. The Pasadika Sutta. No, it's in one of the other ones. So can I have the first one? Give me both of them over here, because I think it must be the first. Oh, actually, I think it might be the fourth. The third one. Hang on. Number 2. Yeah, give them all out here. I'll just check, see if it's in this one first of all. No, there's a nice one. Okay. Here we go. That's right, okay. Sutta. Very, very beautiful, we'll say. Here we go, yes. 111. I'll find it for you. There we go, getting close. Here we go. It may happen, Chunda, this is Pasadika Sutta, that wanderers holding other views than our own may say, those recluses who follow the Sakyan, that's the Buddhist, are addicted and devoted to a life of pleasure. If other people allege this, Chunda, they should be answered that. What, brother, is it to be addicted and devoted to pleasure? For there are many and manifold modes in which one may be so addicted and devoted to pleasure. There are 4 modes, Chunda, which are low and, they've got pagan here, worldly, belonging to the ordinary person. And that is the pleasures of the senses. And it may happen, Chunda, that other teachers may ask,
okay, here we go. This is the one. These are the four modes of being. There are these four modes of being addicted and devoted to pleasure, Chunda, which conduce absolutely to unworldliness, to passionless, to cessation, to peace, to higher knowledge, to enlightenment, to nirvana. The four modes of being addicted to pleasure which lead to nirvana. What are those four? Firstly, Chunda, when a monk aloof from sensual, from the five senses, aloof from they've got evil ideas here, enters into and abides in the first jhana. When they enter and abide in the second jhana. When they enter upon the third jhana and the fourth jhana. These four modes of being addicted and devoted to pleasure, Chunda, conduce to utter unworldliness, to passionless, to cessation, to peace, to insight, to enlightenment, to nirvana. Okay, it's pretty clear. I abbreviated it here. If you want to see it for yourself, I'll leave it here. Open up the page. It's paragraph 24. Pasadika Sutta. Addicted and attached to pleasures, those four pleasures, the first, second, third, fourth jhana, leads to insight, to enlightenment. Very good. I've heard a saying from Sayali, a meditator in Myanmar, that the increase in human population nowadays is also because there's many devas reborn as human now. And that's the reason the new generation of people like to enjoy life partying nowadays, just like devas enjoying their life previously. How can I ensure that I will be able to continue practicing Dharma in future lives? Sadhu 3. There's also many people who have been reborn from the animal realm, which means why we've got so much fighting in the world. And so much adultery as well, because that's what animals do. You know, a dog doesn't mind who it has sex with. Okay, so all of you people who are ever thinking of adultery, what type of human being do you want to be reborn as? Be careful. So I think it's also many people have been come from the animal realm as well, some from the deva realm. Thank you so much for the inspiration of meditation and Dharma talks. Wishing you the best of health to continue your unique and talented ways to propagate Buddhism, especially meditation, to all of us. Looking forward to more meditation retreats with Ajahn Brahm. Oh, you worked me so hard. And the second paragraph, you wish me best of health. And the next paragraph, you wish me to work even harder. Okay, never mind. Oh yes, here we go. Do you believe in UFO? I understand quite a number have been sighted in Stonehenge some time ago. What about Bermuda Triangle? How it got anything to do with the black hole? Are there any connection to Buddhism? I've never seen a UFO, unfortunately. But, interestingly, there's one of my friends who's an Australian monk in Sydney. Name is Harry. Really nice monk. He's just a really down-to-earth Australian man. And he wrote his biography, From Balmain to Buddha, he called it. A very nice book. But he started off like Balmain was the port city of Adelaide. And it was a very, very rough place to grow up. And he started his book by this wonderful opening paragraph. In Balmain, if you still got your front teeth by the age you're five, you're a girl. They would fight, you know, in that place. So he's a very rough guy. But he spent most of his life as a merchant seaman, you know, on these boats going around the world. And he said, and because he's a monk, because I know him, I know he's not lying. He's honest. Monks are honest. You can believe what they say. He said, of all places to be, his boat was in the Bermuda Triangle. And he was on watch in the middle of the night with a first officer. And they saw this weird green light on the horizon. And he called the first officer to see this weird green ball of light on the horizon. And as they watched it, in a second, in speeds unimaginable, it came right over his boat and bathe the whole boat in this weird ethereal green light. The first officer went to wake up the captain, but by that time the light had disappeared. And he said, and he's not joking, he saw that it was the weirdest experience he'd ever had. And he can't explain it. He never saw any craft or any aliens or whatever, but it certainly was strange. And it happened in the Bermuda Triangle. Da da da. So there are weird things, who knows? I do not have a Buddha statue in my house, but I go to the temple to pray. My daughter does not believe in having it in the house because she does not have time for prayer. So to me, everything is in the mind. What do you think about this? I just said even Winston Churchill had a Buddha statue in his house. I know many Christians have Buddhas in their house simply because it reminds them of peace, virtue and compassion. So get one. You don't have to pray to it. What's most important is you look at it every now and again and it makes you be a better person. Then it's done its job. I'm sure that Winston Churchill never prayed to it, and I'm sure that his wife Clementine never gave apples or oranges to Kuan Yin's statue. But they had it there and it helped them enormously. So yeah, get one. I don't believe it. The last question. You haven't got any more in your pocket there, have you? Now here we go. Regarding organ donation, would it be so painful because the brain is not dead yet for the donor that the donor will have a not so good thought right before you die? I guarantee no pain at all, but inspiration instead. So you're giving your organs and you're basically, by that time, you're probably out of your body. Not out of the body, you're in a state where you don't feel any pain. The mind is disconnecting from the brain and you're just looking there and thinking, my goodness, this liver, this heart, which I don't need anymore. He's going to maybe just a young boy who's having to, you know, be in hospital for so many months just waiting for a heart like mine. So this boy can have a beautiful life. And I can be able to go to school, you know, maybe find a nice wife, start a family, have a career. And that's because of this heart, which I don't need anymore, is given to him. And it gives you so much inspiration. Sadhu, 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 I'm making beautiful good karma, helping a person's life. And that's just one of my organs. So you won't feel pain, but you'll feel inspiration. Just like when you're making dana. Who knows, if you're very, very lucky, your kidney might even go to a monk. Ooh, that's big good karma. It's all right to offer an ang pao or offer a robe to a monk, but imagine offering a kidney to a monk. That is huge. So, that could be you. So, make sure you sign up as being an organ donor, and then you can have a happy time. Nothing to be afraid of. So, there we go. All the questions have answered, are they? Or will there be another question coming tomorrow from someplace, somewhere? The only way ever to answer, there's always one coming here. I thought I was finished. Go on, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Very good.
That is torturing.
Yep.
Over here, I don't feel torturing. I've attended a meditation which is really torturing for a week, you know.
Yep, yep.
Without that, you know, I don't like meditation.
Yep.
Okay. Now, with this, it gives me a very good foundation, and I think I will continue. There is inspiration.
Very good.
Thank you, Bhante.
Very good.
The other part is this, we would really hope, you know, in Malaysia, because of I'd like you to come over here to guide us properly, and I hope with your compassion heart, look at us, Malaysia and Singapore. Our population is maybe 10 times as them. Our currency is also different from them. I hope the next time you think of us, you take a plane to come over here and give us more retreat.
My poor arm is hurting. It's crispy.
I tell you what,
I'll leave some of my stem cells. So you can clone me.
First question, Bhante, I mean, we compliment something coming free. First question, Buddha and death, what's the difference between the physical body? Like you say, you know, some people go 8 days, you know, and let's say some people misunderstood, you know, how to handle those differences. Physical, is it still, I believe it's still warm, right?
It's still warm. Actually, that's one thing I forgot to mention. Thank you for that. That's the story of that man who was in jhana when he went to hospital.
Yeah, yeah.
That's one of the other reasons why the doctor never sent him straight down to the morgue, because his body was warm. Where usually it should be cold when there was no heartbeat or no brain activity. So it was warm, and that's actually a very good distinction. Thank you for reminding me of that.
No heartbeat, no.
The heart.
Still warm.
Indeed. Why, I don't know, but that was the case.
Then, after that, immediately, after a bit of time,
yeah. Well, sometimes, apparently, the rebirth can happen almost immediately. So sometimes they can let go of their body and just float off and immediately get into a new womb and get a new rebirth. Almost immediately, yeah. Obviously, in a new womb, in a new fetus, it takes a little bit of a while before the gestation is finished and the birth happens. They can go into the womb pretty quickly sometimes. Yeah. 10 months, yeah, could be. Because they can come into the womb, not just at conception, but sort of during the pregnancy period. Not just the... I think what is it, maybe some gynecologist here, how many weeks before the fetus is considered to be a fetus and not an embryo? Is it 9 weeks? Or? But anyway, there is a time when they say the consciousness manifests, when the brain makes its nervous system so that little being in a mother's womb will respond to pain and pleasure. So you can actually see it moving. You know, if there's a stimulus, like a sharp object. Before that, at that time, when there is a viable nervous system, at that time it can actually go in there. So sometimes it's 4 or 5 months, 6 months maybe, before birth, that the new stream of consciousness enters the mum's womb. Yeah. More female. Is that the case? I thought it's pretty more female these days. That's interesting. I don't really know that. Maybe you got me on that one. Jealousy? But that means you get more females. I don't know. Maybe it's because men have to go to war and have to work much harder than females. But actually, it works out both ways. Females have their share of pain. Men have their share of pain. I don't really know that one. I'll pass on that one. Why there's more females? I never thought there was. I thought it was pretty even. More females now. Fascinating. Yeah.
Is there a difference between Arahant and Buddha and
Hot Seat Yoma and enlightenment? My goodness. First of all, the Arahant and the Buddha, they all have the same attainment. Having overcome all of the defilements. So they've destroyed the seed which will give rise to rebirth, which is the illusion of a self and craving. So in many senses they are similar. They often say that the Buddha, because he was the first Arahat of the group, had much greater powers, which is also very true. So, in substance, the same, but in the way that substance manifests, they're smarter and stronger. As far as the fourth jhana is concerned, that is, you may say, that's actually not. That's just a great state of stillness. That's the sort of place where the Arahats and the Buddha will spend most of their time, in that deep stillness. It gives you a taste of nirvana, because many, many things have vanished there. And so this is roughly what happens. But it's after you emerge from the jhanas, when the five hindrances and the defilements are subdued for long periods of time, there's no desire, there's no ill will once you emerge from these deep states of meditation, now you know what it feels like to be an Arahat. no desire, no ill will, incredible compassion and joy. So you're getting a taste of what it feels like to have no defilements for hours on end until they start coming back again. Okay? Enlightenment is actually that insight which gives rise to being an arahat. In other words, instead of an enlightenment, as I mentioned the other day, call it awakening. So at last your mind is clear enough to see the truth. Yes, in the back. Okay. When can you do a transfer of cash? While you're earning it, or after it's been deposited in the bank? So you've got to earn it first of all, have it deposited in the bank, and then you can do the transfer. So that's why it's best to do the transfer of merits after you've done the good karma. So do the good karma first of all, and at the very end, you do the transference of merits. It needs also to be said that transferring of merits is also in itself good karma. You've made lots and lots of good money, you're transferring it. When you transfer the money over to some relation who's dead, that's the karma money, you also get a commission. That's true, you get your good karma. Yes? Yes, of course it does. Donating a dialysis machine does save lives, but also it does... No. Yes, no, it's still a beautiful thing because your intention is to relieve suffering. If it's your intention is to relieve suffering so the person can live a bit longer, because maybe by donating the dialysis machine you're giving them those few months necessary until one of the Buddhists in this retreat dies and gives their kidneys because they've been encouraged to be organ donors, and then they have a life, they don't need dialysis anymore, but by giving them that temporary reprieve from death until they get a proper organ, you are helping them extend their life enormously. So it's a good thing to do. Any act of kindness, compassion is good. Yep. Actually, is it the parents or the relations who have control of your body after death? Or can you give like a will to say, I want my organs to be given, and your parents have to follow that? Good, good. Very good. Okay. Yeah, please say yes. Otherwise you're making very, very bad karma. Yes. Yeah. And then they take the organs out. And you come out of jhana, you've got no organs left. Oh dear. It's very, 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 very unlikely that that would ever happen. And again, they'll see that you are warm and not cold. It's something different than being dead. And so a decent doctor will say, no, they're still going, so they're still alive. It's also up to me to tell doctors that if you get taken to a hospital, if they see someone who goes into the hospital in full lotus and they think they've died and they're not dead, please check to see whether in jhana before you send them straight down to the morgue or take their organs out. It's very, very rare that will happen anyway, so you've got no real chance of that. And anyway, if you do die in that jhana, or you know, usually you don't die in jhana, but if you do go in jhana and take all your organs out, that means you get reborn in this jhana world for eons. You're going to have bliss for such a long time. But when you come out of that state, oh, you're going to have such amazingly good karma, you'll probably get enlightened pretty quickly. So it's a win-win situation. You can't lose by getting jhanas. But a lot of times, they may have trouble getting your organs out. The reason is that there's been these couple of cases. I told that case about that monk who was submerged. But I didn't tell the cases in the Majjhima Nikaya. There was one monk who got into a jhana in the forest, and he was happily meditating there, but there was a couple of Buddhist villagers who happened to be in the forest collecting mushrooms or wood or something, and they saw this monk sitting absolutely still, not breathing, and they thought, oh my goodness, the monk has died. And they, being Buddhists, they said, we can't just let him stay here and be eaten by the jungle animals, we have to cremate him. So, being in a forest, there's plenty of wood around, they collected some wood, made a pyre, lifted the monk, put him on top, and lit the wood. And when the fire was well established, they're busy people, they can't wait around for the body to be burnt. So when they realized the fire was lit, it wouldn't go out, and the monk would be burnt, then they went off to do their business. And they were very surprised the next morning when the monk came into their village on arms round. We just cremated you yesterday. But it seems to be that if you get into a jhana, even your robes don't get burnt, let alone your skin. So I don't know, when they try to cut your body open, you know, to get your organs out, you know, the scalpel must be blood. Nothing's working. No. That's the trouble, because I tell so many jokes, no one knows. That's a real story. That's in the books.
One thing I like about that, maybe question. I think we don't have to worry, because nowadays a lot of medical doctors, they know what meditation is. They know what stage meditation people are. It's recognized by Kaizen Institute, by Mental Health Institute. They will tell patients go meditate. So don't worry, I suppose.
Okay.
They told me how to meditate.
Yeah.
But they know what meditation is.
Yeah.
And all my friendships know what is alpha, what is beta, they have alpha, beta, stage. You know.
Anyway, it'd be interesting to find out. But you won't lose anyway, but get into jhana first before you start worrying about it. Yes, go on. Yeah, it's a great thing to do. Buddhist view, yeah, because you know, you get so old and so sick that sometimes, as I said last night, you don't want so much interference with your dying process. So you said, okay, I've lived a good life, I've made lots of good karma, it's time to go now, let me go. So just let nature take its course, as they say. And this is not killing yourself, because it means you're just not interfering to prolong your life. So it's not killing, deliberately ending your life, it's not prolonging it for no good purpose. So just let the body go. And that is fine. Yep. Ah, that was, I know that person, that was called Mary, wasn't it? The kid was called Jesus. That probably happened yesterday, Christmas Day. Now, there are some many straight... Yeah, okay. You said it actually happened. They saw this beautiful white light and she got pregnant. It wasn't for her husband. Oh, there's another special being coming. Jesus is back again. Now, it's really weird because I'm not quite sure that... There are some very many weird and strange things happen. It's unlikely, I'm sure it's probably that, you know, they did have sex sometimes, especially if you've got a boyfriend, she's been married. So the same thing to do is when that, if she's pregnant and she does give birth, do a DNA test. That will soon prove who the father is. That's why they should have done that on Jesus, the DNA test, you know. Find out whether it really was immaculate. Yes? And this is fourth jhana. Fourth jhana heartbeat stops. Before then it's still going. Yes?
This is not related to meditation. I wonder, in Malaysia, allow me to inject and die, even though a person has been bedridden for 7 years, or even in coma for 10 years. Now, if this person so wish to, like in a will, if they opt for to coma, they fly to Australia and get, you know, sort of injected them.
Yeah.
Is it available?
Yeah. Australia doesn't approve it yet, but countries like Switzerland do. That's called Exit International Dignitas Clinic in Switzerland. You can fly there, and if you've got like chronic disease like cancers, you can have what's called voluntary euthanasia. So basically, the doctor hooks you onto an intravenous, and there is drugs which give you a pain-free death. And you have the computer screen in front of you, and you have to go through a number of hoops, pressing the computer screen. Do you know what you're doing? If you continue, this will cause your death. Now, are you talked it over with your family? Whatever. I'm not quite sure what the questions are. It's quite complex to make sure the person is in full control of their faculties, is not being coerced, and they freely choose to end their life. But I think they have to go through two doctors' approvals first of all, to make sure that it is a terminal illness, there's no reasonable possibility of a cure, and they decide that this is the way they want to end their life. And as far as I'm concerned as a Buddhist, that is ethical. You are in control of your karma. However, if somebody else kills you, that's breaking a precept. But if it's like you kill yourself, which is voluntary euthanasia, that's a voluntary, you do it. And you exercise your choice, and you think you're doing it out of compassion, then it's ethical. And the problem is that you have to be very, very careful that people aren't being coerced, especially by their family, because they're fed up with paying hospital bills, and they want the inheritance pretty quickly, so they say, come on, Grandma, it's time you go. Of course, that type of coercion is unethical. But if it's like ethical, in the sense that it's your free choice, without any coercion, you've got a terminal illness, and you feel that there's no point in prolonging this process. There are places, I think in Oregon, United States, I think also in Holland, I believe, and also in Switzerland. They don't care which nationality they take here. The organization is called Dignitas in sort of Switzerland. Many people go there. You have to be very careful there, because I think in the UK there's a problem, because the persons were getting very sick that it was their spouse, their husband or their wife, organised everything and paid for it. And according to UK law, that means they assisted the suicide. And so they were taken to court, but the judge refused to prosecute them, because they said, you know, that it was not in the public interest. In other words, they say it was against the law, but in that situation it was not sort of so much against the law to be unethical that deserved a sentence. But it was somebody asked the House of Lords to try and clarify the situation, and they could not clarify it. So it was a grey area there, because the law did not want to have anyone assist suicide, because they were thinking of like helping someone jump off a bridge when there were a young man or something who lost his girlfriend. But then they found it very difficult to address the issue of someone with a terminal illness and constant pain, with no hope of any quality of life. Other jurisdictions, such as Switzerland, Oregon, United States and Holland, they did consider it and they made it allowable, with a lot of safeguards to make sure it's not abused. Okay, but as somebody said, it's not youth in Asia which is a problem, it's youth all over the world. Youth in Asia. Okay, that's a terrible joke. But it's now time to finish. So, Engcho, what are we going to do next now? Final advice. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. So to start us off. Very good. So again, whatever you do in life, give it lots of energy, then you never get depressed. If you're working, you have to go to work, so put energy and fun into it, put passion into it. When you go to the dentist,
put fun and energy and passion into it. Whatever you have to do in life, if you have to go to work on a Monday morning or Sunday, whatever you go to work, don't go, oh God, I've got to work again, I hate going to work. Then you make yourself depressed. So put energy, you're going to be doing something to serve the nation or serve the company. At the very least, you're going to get some money you can use for donations or charities or whatever. You're doing something useful. So you can always see the bright side and put energy, put positive energy into whatever you're doing, and then you'll be much happier. And also when you come to the temple, heaps and heaps of positive energy. And then you'll find your meditation takes off as well, because it feeds on the positive energies. Okay, very good. So when you're at home, please meditate a lot. Next time there's a retreat, not necessarily Ajahn Brahm, whoever's there, because you know that no matter what they're teaching you, they don't know what you're doing when you close your eyes and sit down. You do whatever technique you want. So that way you can meditate any way you wish, and meditate at home, go to temples, and then make sure you don't waste a human life.